stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-800-585-9396.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-800-585-9396.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you?
You.
This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion. What is it? It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Why do we do this program? Well, because here at EWTN, we love the Catholic faith. We believe in the Catholic faith. We point to the Catholic Church as having the truth. This is the mess. This is the the church that Jesus founded, and we want to share that good news with everybody. So that's why we do a program like this that answers questions from people like you. Here's our phone number, 1-800-585-9396, 1-800-585-9396. If you're a texting type, you can text the letters EWTN to 55000, wait for the response, and then text us your first name and your brief message. Message and data rates may apply. Again, the phone number, 1-800-585-9396. Calls are starting to come in right now. And by the way, if you have an email inclination, you can certainly email us, ctc@ewtn.com. We have kind of depleted the mailbag. We just put one in the can that's going to air on the 4th of July. So the mailbag's looking kind of lightweight at the moment. So feel free to send us those email questions, ctc@ewtn.com. Michael McCall is our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Doing very well. How about you, my friend?
I'm doing all right, thanks.
You're getting ready to head out of town, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I am.
You're going to Orlando for the convocation.
That's right.
Of Catholic leaders.
And EWTN, which is everywhere, will be there.
We will indeed. Our own Jack Williams will be there, and you're going to be there. The Pop Checks will be there.
Oh, nice.
And some other good folks will be doing some broadcasting from Orlando, including our program on Monday.
Yes, but ironically, I'm actually not going as a representative of EWTN, though I'll be representing EWTN when I'm down there.
No, right, you're actually going as a spy, am I right?
I'm going as a representative of the Birmingham Diocese, because that's my day job when I'm not on the radio, right?
Okay.
And this is a meeting for bishops, priests, diocesan workers, catechists, evangelists, anybody that's involved in the catechetical and evangelistic mission of the church, to talk about how we can do that job better in forming missionary disciples throughout the church in North America.
That is very exciting. So you will not be on the program on Friday, because we will have a mailbag program, because you'll be in Orlando. And then we'll do the program live from Orlando on Monday, and then we'll have another mailbag on the 4th of July.
Right.
We'll get it all wrapped up there, and in a moment here, we will get to the phone calls at 1-800-585-9396. Let us lead off here, though, with an email from Ryan. He says, Dr. Anders, I would like to ask your Protestant expertise in Reformation history to help me understand sola fide. Martin Luther once said, it is the article with and by which the church stands or falls. So could you explain how and why the Protestant Reformation came up with a different view on justification? Could you please explain how justification taught by the Roman Catholic Church is the correct and original gospel, and why the Protestant view on justification is incorrect? Signed, a lost Protestant, Ryan.
Ryan, thank you very much. I really appreciate the question. So you're correct. Luther, this statement is attributed to Luther. It's unlikely Luther actually ever said it. However, it's an accurate reflection of Luther's actual belief.
Okay.
He once said that if the Pope would only teach the article on justification, that he would bow down and kiss the Pope's feet. You know, for him, it was not about indulgences, it was not about penances, it wasn't about abuses in the church or corruption or whatever other reason somebody might allege for the Reformation. For Luther, it was all about dogma, and it was all about this dogma, the idea that a person is saved by faith alone, apart from the interior moral transformation in the inner man. Luther, of course, believed in sanctification. He believed that a person ought to try to strive for holiness. He just thought that had nothing to do with the question of justification. All right. Now, in terms of why Luther came up with this and where it comes from, Protestant historians, not Catholics, Protestant historians freely admit today that Luther's doctrine was an utter theological novelty with no precedent at all in the Christian tradition for 1,500 years. Nobody has stated it more forcefully, I think, more helpfully than Alistair McGrath, who's an Anglican evangelical Protestant theologian, who wrote one of the definitive works on the history of the doctrine. In his two-volume book, Justitia Dei, which is a history of the doctrine of justification, McGrath, the Protestant, forms a judgment that Luther's peculiar understanding of the nature of justification was, and I'm going to quote him, a complete theological novum, an absolute novelty. Nobody knew this before Luther.
So I don't mean to interrupt, but he's saying that it's a novelty, but he's also saying that it's not true?
Oh, McGrath is a Protestant. So he thinks Luther is right, but he just admits that nobody held Luther's doctrine until Luther.
I see. Okay.
And McGrath is not the only one. T.F. Torrance, another very well-known Protestant historian of dogma. Adolf von Harnack, early 20th century, late 19th century, famous Protestant historian of dogma. You'll find the same conclusions drawn in other theological works by Protestant scholars. This is something that Luther came up with on his own. Okay. Now there are, in terms of making sense of it, one thing we ought to dispense with right away. Mm-hmm. This is not just a simple matter of Luther reading the Bible and seeing something that nobody else saw before. All right, that's a very, very naive way of depicting this. All right, first of all, because it's not in the Bible. All right, but more importantly, I mean, earlier in another show we were talking about this, and I pointed out sometimes Protestants will naively assert that it had to do with the rediscovery of the Greek language and Erasmus's Greek edition of the New Testament, and now we're getting around all this Latin stuff that the Roman Catholic Church had brought in. Get back to the original text and really see what St. Paul meant. Not true. All right, okay. Not true at all. All you got to do is look at the Greek church. There was no going back to the Greek for them.
That's true.
And you don't find anything like Lutheranism. You don't find it in the Greek church. You don't find it in the Syriac church. You don't find it in the Coptic church. This is not just some problem that Catholics thought up to get the Christian faith away from the original gospel, which mm-hmm. is the way Luther depicted it. Mm-hmm. No, no. I mean, nowhere in the Christian world, Catholic, Orthodox, Oriental Orthodox, I mean, there's nothing in Christian history for 1,500 years, Greek, Latin, Syriac, Coptic, you name it, Ethiopian, nobody comes up with this stuff, right? Luther himself says in multiple places, he says, I did not come up with this from books. He says, I came up with this, basically in the crucible of my own tortured interior life. All right. Now, he tries to justify it from Scripture, but Luther, he says, it's not reading and studying that makes a theologian. It's living and dying that make a theologian.
Mm.
And Luther had a very tortured psychology. I think today, if you put him on the couch, he'd probably be diagnosed as bipolar, obsessive-compulsive disorder, mm-hmm. scrupulosity type.
Uh-huh.
All right. And Luther had to do great violence to the text of the Bible to force this interpretation, which he freely acknowledges. All right, Luther invents an entire hermeneutic. Hermeneutic means a philosophy of interpretation.
Uh-huh.
All right, that again nobody had ever heard of, where he says you have to read the Bible as fundamentally two types of texts. According to Luther, there's law and gospel. Gospel is the promise of grace, and the law is the imposition of some sort of moral demand. And he says, anytime you encounter, this is Luther talking,
yeah.
anytime you encounter a moral demand, you're not to take it at face value. It's there to frighten you so that you'll run and embrace grace. And he comes up with this because he understands that 99% of the Bible is description of what proper moral behavior ought to look like. And Jesus, taken at face value, can be kind of a harsh moralist. Makes a lot of pretty hardcore demands. If you look at a woman with lust, you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. Unless you do this, that, and the other thing, you won't inherit the kingdom of God. So Luther says, all of that you have to throw away. You can't read Jesus at face value, according to Martin Luther. He says, Jesus is really trying to fool you. He's pulling your leg. He doesn't mean what he says. That's all just law to scare you into grace. All right. Well, that's a crazy idea. I mean, he completely denudes 98% of the Bible of its meaning in order to twist it around a very idiosyncratic interpretation of two passages, Romans 3 and 4 and Galatians 2, 3 and 4. Right? Where the Catholic tradition has always read the Bible as much more intelligible than that. That Jesus meant what he said and said what he meant. Okay?
Yep.
Where did Luther get these ideas from? Well, I'm running a bit long on the call, I know, but there are some philosophical developments in late medieval nominalism, a school of radical skeptical philosophy that emerged at Oxford in the 14th century that has some explanatory power for where Luther was getting his stuff from. Also, Luther's engagement with some elements of German mystical theology. I mean, you can find some. Not exact precedents, but you can kind of find a philosophical religious milieu that helps explain Luther together with the crucible of his own tortured emotional life. And what he ultimately comes up with is something that's just radically discontinuous, not only with Scripture, but with the Catholic tradition. Now, in another call, perhaps, we'll go into the Catholic doctrine of justification. Sure. And why it makes a lot more sense of the biblical data.
Okay. Ryan, we thank you very much for your email. You call yourself in your email a lost Protestant. We invite you to check out what the Catholic Church has to offer. In a moment, we'll be talking with Larry in Shelby Township, Michigan, Nabil in Novi, Michigan, I know where that is, and Mike in Chicago, all coming up on this edition of Call to Communion on EWTN.
Sharing the fullness of the Catholic faith. 1-800-585-9396. This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
It's the start of a new day for Morning Catholic Radio.
And Gloria keeps Mother Angelica's perpetual calendar handy.
Where most men work for degrees after their names, we work for one before our names, Saint. It's a much more difficult degree to attain. It takes a lifetime, and you don't get your diploma until you're dead.
That may be my favorite quote from Mother Angelica.
Morning Glory, Catholic from the start. Weekday mornings, 7 Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Have you heard about Church Pop? Church Pop features new online Christian content that's fun and inspiring every day. Find it on Snapchat, Instagram, and on the web at churchpop.com.
Celebrating 100 years of Fatima with Monsignor Charles Pope.
In August of 1917, Our Lady said to the children at Fatima, "Pray. Pray very much and make sacrifices for sinners, for many souls go to hell because there are none to sacrifice themselves and pray for them." We live in times where many people think nobody's going to hell, but the children actually saw hell. Our Lady showed them hell and that there were many, many souls there. We have to accept that, sadly, many have chosen against God. Can we pray for their conversion? Our Lady simply says, "Pray, pray, many souls go to hell because no one prays for them." Are we willing to pray for them? Do we have the same urgency that Our Lady and our Lord does for the souls who are on that wide road leading to damnation? Pray for them every day. Our Lady asks us, pray for the conversion of sinners.
Join EWTN as we celebrate the 100th anniversary of Fatima. Visit EWTN.com/Fatima.
This is Colleen Kelly Mast.
Hello, this is Archbishop Charles J. Chaput, the Archbishop of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
This is Catherine Seltner, host of EWTN Pro Life Weekly. Thanks for listening to EWTN Radio.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews. 1-800-585-9396.
If you're ready now, let's get to the phones at 1-800-585-9396. Larry in Shelby Township, Michigan, kicks us off. He's listening to Sirius XM 130. And Larry, what is your question today?
Hi, Dr. Anders. Thanks for all you do. I love your show. Listen to it every day. My question is with Adam and Eve, with their kids. I think Cain was the bad one. He killed his brother. And then God puts a mark on his forehead. For all the other people to see. My question is, who were the other people?
Right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. So, and thank you for your kind words also. St. Augustine, who is a 4th century doctor of the Church, one of the greatest theologians in Catholic history and a frequent commentator about the book of Genesis, wrote a whole book on the book of Genesis called On the Literal Meaning of Genesis, in which he concluded it ain't literal, a lot of it. Yeah. All right. So this is not something that modern Catholic theologians have made up. This is really the consistent position of Catholic teachers down through the ages. Points out in The City of God, Book 10, Chapter 8, I'm looking at the text right now, he says people forget fail to take into account that the writer of the sacred history does not necessarily mention all the men who might be alive at that time, but those only whom the scope of this work required him to name. All right. And Augustine himself understands Cain and Abel in this passage as historical people, but also as archetypes of types of human person. All right. And Augustine's whole book is meant to display that there are really two fundamental orientations that people take in life, either for God or against God. And those that are for God, Augustine says, these are those who dwell in the city of God. All right, that's what the whole book is about. It's about tracing the history of the sacred history of God's people throughout history, from the beginning of time to the end. Cain and Abel are really archetypes of that. So we're not meant to take this passage as exclusive of any other humans that might exist at the time.
Okay. Is that helpful for you, Larry?
Yes, I've always wondered that. Okay, I appreciate that so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate your call. That opens up a line for you now, 1-800-585-9396, 1-800-585-9396. Blaze in La Mirada, California, watching us on YouTube right now, says, is penance the same as an indulgence?
No, it's not. I appreciate the question. To understand the doctrine of indulgences, you have to understand penance. All right, so indulgence presupposes penance. Penance does not presuppose indulgence. Penance is when we attempt to make, or we do make, some kind of reparation for sin. All right?
Okay.
And sometimes non-Catholics get a little bit confused. They say, well, aren't your sins forgiven? Why would you need to make a reparation? And anybody who's ever offended his wife knows that forgiveness is one thing and penance is something else. You know,
yeah.
Wife can say, I forgive you. But unless you're a real so-and-so, you're still going to come with the box of chocolates and the flowers, okay? And same thing holds with God. All right? God can forgive us, and yet it's still just, it's still appropriate that we make some act of reparation. That's penance, okay? Now, in the ancient church, the church, by its own authority, can impose penances on sinners. Right? It should do this, and it's told, Jesus tells us to do this, all right? And in antiquity, it wasn't uncommon for some of these penances to be rather lengthy, particularly for very grave sins. Mm. Somebody might be deprived of Holy Communion, for instance, for most of their life. They might have to. There was a place in the church called the Order of Penitence. People sit in the back, all right, and they might be consigned to the Order of Penitence for years at a time.
Wow!
And an interesting thing happened in the Decian persecution in the 250s A.D. in North Africa. All right, there were people who were being martyred for the faith, and then there were people that were denying Christ under persecution. And that's a grave sin. That's called apostasy.
Mm-hmm.
And the church was excluding those people from Holy Communion. They were forgiving them, readmitting to the church, but said, look, you just can't jump back in with both feet. You can't just deny Christ and come right back. Okay, you got to do penance. And sometimes those penances were quite lengthy. We had another class of people called confessors. All right, and these were people who were confessing Christ but had not yet gone to martyrdom. They were being imprisoned, tortured. Sometimes they were on their way to martyrdom.
Mm.
And an interesting thing happened. Some of these people who were doing penance for having apostatized were going to the confessors in prison and saying, would you lend me a little bit of your merit? You know,
really?
It's meritorious to confess Christ.
Uh-huh.
That's meritorious.
Yes.
Right? It's pleasing to God. You're earning favor. You're earning reward in heaven for that. And they're like, give me some of that, all right? I'm doing penance down here. Couldn't some of your merit counterbalance a little bit of my demerit? Couldn't I get some time off of my penance? And now this was a little bit squirrely.
Okay.
Some of these dudes in prison were saying, sure thing. And they were writing out these writs of indulgence and then giving them to the penitents and saying, okay, go take this to your priest, go take this to your bishop, and tell them you need to get off, you know, 5 years of purgatory. I mean, not 5 years of purgatory, 5 years of your penance. And Cyprian, the bishop of Carthage, said, boys, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. But the interesting thing, when you trace this out in the literature, you read the letters, Cyprian never denies the theological principle. He never denies that the merits of the few might be applied to the benefit of the many. Because that's a very biblical principle. You think about Abraham pleading with God about Sodom. Will you destroy the righteous along with the wicked? God says, no, for the sake of the 10 righteous, I'll spare everybody. Right? The idea that the righteous few might intercede on behalf of the wicked many, very biblical idea. Works backwards, too. Remember, God punished all of Israel for Achan's sin. Right? So Cyprian doesn't dispute that. He says, okay, yeah, you guys are meritorious. Y'all have done something that's above and beyond. It's supernatural charity. And that's meritorious. And because we all believe in the communion of saints, we all share together in the goods, the spiritual and material of the church, that could be applied on behalf of these sinners. But it's got to go through the church. That has to fall to the bishop's discretion to issue these writs of indulgence. And the indulgence here, what was the indulgence? We're not talking time off in purgatory. We're talking time out of the order of penitence at the back of the church. All right, that's the origin of the thing. So the language that's attached to indulgences of so many months or days or years off, it's not a reference to purgatory. It's a reference to this time in the order of penitence. Now, but then the question arises, well, if I'm doing penance in purgatory, can the merits of the saints and the martyrs be applied for me too? And the obvious answer is yes, because the same spiritual principle is involved. Namely, the merit of the saints can be applied on behalf of the penances of those both in this life and in purgatory. All right?
Okay.
And it's the church who has the jurisdiction to distribute those graces. So that's the historical origin of the practice of indulgences, and it's attached to the logic of penance.
Okay. We hope that's helpful for you, Blaise. Thanks for checking us out via YouTube. If you would like to send us a question via YouTube or Facebook Live, you can certainly do that right down there in the comments section on your computer screen. Let's go now to Mike in Chicago. Well, let me give you the phone number first, 1-800-585-9396. If you have a question for Dr. David Andrews, 1-800-585-9396. Now let's go to Mike in Chicago, listening to EWTN Radio on Sirius XM 130. Mike, what's your question today?
Just wanted to ask Dr. Andrews if Martin Luther, what was his beef and what triggered him to fracture from the church? And the other follow-up really quick was your conversion from Protestants to Catholicism. Were you obviously more on the Luther side and now that obviously you're Catholic convert, does Luther come into play in terms of your understanding? I guess what I'm trying to say now, do you like you're anti-Luther, now you're or you're pro-Luther, anti-Luther?
Yeah, I understand the question. I appreciate it a lot.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
convert,
yeah, sure.
How do you reconcile Luther and all the historians and the scholars? Do you have to kind of really dig deep?
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. Okay, so in terms of what triggered Luther, the origins of the Reformation is a very complex question. There's so many things that go into this, so I can't do justice to it in 3 minutes, okay? But briefly, Luther was a very tortured, tormented person who had, probably today we would diagnose him as OCD, obsessive compulsive, bipolar depression. Mm-hmm. He talked a lot about his depression. He called it Anfechtung in German, and he would speak about his Anfechtung almost like he would personify it, okay, and do battle with it. And it stayed with him his entire life, and he had these tremendous highs and these tremendous lows, and he felt an just absolute burden of guilt. All right, I really was a little bit unbalanced in that regard, but like many people who may be a little bit kind of squirrely in the emotional life, he was an absolutely brilliant intellect. Okay, there's a passage in the 95 Theses, with his objection to the church's sale of indulgences, Tetzel's sale of indulgences, that's really illuminating. And I was trying to find it earlier, and I hadn't had enough time to pull it up. But basically, I'm gonna paraphrase. He speaks about the torture, the suffering of conscience that he experiences as being greater than the pains of purgatory, so why bother with purgatory? You know,
wow.
I mean, like part of his logic for why indulgences, why penances, why not get rid of these things is he's like, I'm already suffering so much interiorly. You know, you can't heap any more on me. That's the kind of interior life the man led.
Mm.
All right. And you can't live with that for too long without finally just snapping.
Sure.
And so what he does is he takes his own tortured interior life, his own sort of neurotic spirituality, as the model for all of Christendom. and then thinks up a theology that really makes normative this experience of radical depression and radical release, and then says this is what characterizes the Christian life, is these absolute lows and these just tremendous ecstatic highs. So, and he tells us explicitly, I think it's in the Disputation Against Scholastic Theology, where he says, it's not by reading and studying you become a theologian, it's by living and dying. All right?
Yeah.
And he says, I didn't learn this in books, I learned it in the crucible of my own interior life. So really, this is where the Reformation comes from, in mm-hmm. large measure, is from Luther's own tortured psychology.
Okay.
Now, how do I feel about Luther? All right. Luther said, I empathize with Luther. I feel bad for him. I pity for Luther because of how tortured he was. But it led him to some really absurd theological conclusions that I think are very, very dangerous. And I'll come back and touch on those a little bit after the break.
Sounds like a plan. So, Mike, hang in there with us. We'll get a little bit more from Dr. David Anders on your question. Got a line open for you, too, 1-800-585-9396, 1-800-585-9396 for Call to Communion.
Colin Donovan.
Entering university, I had the religious understanding of someone catechized in the 1960s. That changed when a fellow freshman asked me if a Catholic could use the pill. My uninformed answer was, sure, why not? I then went and read Pope Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae and concluded, this is truth. I've never looked back in my love of our Catholic faith since.
Open Line with Colin Donovan, Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Hello, this is Dr. Alveda King of Priest for Life with Pro-Life Update. We sometimes hear from those on the other side of the pro-life battle that they want to work together with us to, quote, reduce the need for abortion. It is part of our pro-life mission to reduce the numbers of abortions, and in fact, our goal is not just to reduce it, but to end it. We have to start by making it clear that there is no need for abortion in the first place. No abortion is necessary, neither medically nor morally. Women get abortions not because of freedom of choice, but because they feel they have no freedom and no choice. Yet when the people of God provide better choices, the way is clear to help both mother and child. Yes, we will reduce abortions, but let's never imply that there is a need for abortion. This is Alveda King on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Catholic Radio gives us an opportunity to become part of a larger family. It can be so lonely when we are struggling in our faith or just trying to live our faith on our own. But Catholic Radio connects us to that larger community of faith where we're able to get the support, the encouragement, and the grace that we need to not just struggle on, but to really celebrate all the blessings that God brings into our life through our Catholic faith.
Dr. Greg Popchak thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews. 1-800-585-9396.
On many of these EWTN radio stations, coming up next, it'll be Father Mitch Pacwa on Open Line it's Wednesday, EWTN Open Line Wednesday. He'll be talking about church teachings. Today at 4 on many of our stations, on Cresta in the afternoon, Catherine Pacaluk, Economics of Education. Probably should have read this first. Economics of Education with Catherine Pacaluk. And then Father John Ricardo will be along with some good news. Heaven Starts Now. That'll be on with Al Cresta today at 4 p.m. Eastern. At 6 on Catholic Answers Live, Paul George explores finding happiness in your vocation. And then Dennis McNamara will talk about why we need beautiful churches. And you know what? We really do. And then tonight at 8 on EWTN Live, Father Mitch is back on EWTN Radio and Television, a very special program, an important program, Remembering Terry Schiavo. His guest will be the Most Reverend Charles Chaput of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia and Bobby Schindler, brother of Terry Schiavo. They'll be remembering and discussing the necessity of promoting human dignity and defending the most vulnerable. I cannot think of a more important program. Do check that out tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio and Television. Oh, by the way, we also have a special programming note for you, and that'll be tomorrow morning, Thursday morning on our other network, EWTN Radio Classics, beginning at 3:30 in the morning Eastern Time. We will broadcast the solemnity of the Feast of St. Peter and Paul, and that'll be live from Rome. Again, that's at 3:30 in the morning on EWTN Radio Classics, which you can get on your mobile device and also by going to EWTNradio.net. Got one to a little bit longer of a question for you here, David, and we'll get to that in a moment. But we were still talking with Blaze in California.
He wanted to know how I felt about Luther as a convert from the Protestant tradition and the origins of the Reformation. And I touched on the fact before the break that Luther, a lot of Luther's theologizing emerged from his own tortured psychology. And he freely tells us this. I'm not just imposing this interpretation on him.
Yeah.
And that figures into how I think about Luther. All right. Luther could not figure out a way to live with the idea of moral responsibility. He thought that whatever he did was going to fall short of the divine command. He could never find peace of conscience. Nothing his confessor said would give him any peace. And so he ultimately ended up rejecting the whole idea of moral responsibility as having anything to do with our relationship with God. Now, in the civil sphere, you know, in family life, in government, he recognized the purpose of law and punishment and all that. But when it came to his relationship with God, he just utterly rejected the idea of moral responsibility altogether. Most people are familiar that Luther invents this doctrine of justification by faith alone, the idea that God accepts us just on the basis of faith, not because of anything that we do. What they may not know is that Luther took this idea of rejecting moral responsibility so seriously that he completely rejected the idea of human freedom, that there was any human agency at all right, that that humans could act in any way as be the author of their own deeds, okay? And he writes a book about it in 1525 called On the Bondage of the Will, where he asserts not only are humans not free, but there is no meaningful human agency at all. We are not actual agents contributing anything to the course of reality, right? And argues that everything is caused immediately by the divine will. Okay. Now, this is very similar to positions that were taken by, say, the Muslim philosopher Al-Ghazali. Al-Ghazali once claimed that that fire does not burn a cotton ball, but God causes the cotton ball to burn in the presence of the fire. It's a philosophical position called occasionalism, all right? There are no secondary causes. There are no instrumental causes in reality. Everything is just immediately caused by the will of God. And what appears to be causation is just illusion, all right? Now, the Protestant theologian John Calvin, heavily influenced by Luther, argued the same thing. He said, bread doesn't nourish us. God causes the body to be nourished in the presence of the bread. All right. Radical denial that there's any kind of agency in the world apart from the immediate will of God. Total fatalism. Now, that destroys philosophical and scientific knowledge, because all of our knowledge is knowledge of causes. That's what knowledge consists in. It's understanding the nature of a thing and how it interacts with its environment and tracing things by way of cause and effect. If you deny that there are causes, you destroy human rationality. All right. And Luther understood how radical a position he was taking, and that his moral doctrine was abhorrent to human intuition about the nature of morality and the just and the unjust and the good and the bad. And he said he embraced that. And he says in The Bondage of the Will, he says, I know this is absurd. That's why I believe it, because if it made sense, it wouldn't be divine.
Right.
So he posits of God absolute incomprehensibility, says that anything divine is so radically disconnected from us as to appear absurd and irrational. So he is an irrationalist. Now, I think these are very dangerous positions to take. The rejection of reason, the rejection of moral responsibility, the rejection of human agency, born out of a tortured psychology. So I'm empathetic towards Luther. All right. I feel bad for him because of his tortured interior experience, but I think it led him down some very, very dangerous paths.
Thank you so much for your call. We do appreciate it. Here's our phone number, 1-800-585-9396, 1-800-585-9396. Here's that letter from Chris, who says, Dr. Anders, I'm a 40-year-old man who was born and raised in a Protestant environment. Through research on my own and through the help of your show, I'm coming to a better understanding of what the Catholic faith is all about. I'm feeling a strong gravitational pull towards the Catholic Church, but I know it's going to cause controversy in my family and my personal life if I decide to do so. I'm more than willing to take this controversy head on, but I need your help. One of the strongest influences on why I believe the Catholic Church to be church is that God intended for his people is 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 10,
yep.
In which Paul is talking about the division of the church. In your experience, what is the typical Protestant defense on why this Bible verse does not apply to them in regards to separating from the Catholic Church? What should I say to them in return in defense of the Catholic faith? Thanks. Really enjoy your show. I look forward to listening to you daily. That's Christopher in Washington Courthouse, Ohio.
Okay, so Christopher has pointed to a really, really strong motive for becoming Catholic, namely that the Catholic Church gives us a principled way to come to visible doctrinal agreement about the content of the Christian faith. And outside of the Catholic Church, there is no agreement. Well, you've got thousands of different Protestant denominations that differ from one another in really substantive ways about the meaning of the Christian life, the nature of morality, the knowledge of God, you name it. They really, really differ in very fundamental ways. And now, the commonly today, if you encounter a Protestant, you make this claim to them, you'll get a response like this. They'll say, well, yeah, we differ, but not on the essentials. That's the assertion that's made. Not on the essentials, right? Mm-hmm. On the essentials, we agree. Well, I mean, Jesus never said agree on the essentials. Paul didn't say agree on the essentials. He said
true.
Agree on everything.
Right? Right.
But even if that were the case, it still is a question-begging argument because it goes to the question, well, what are the essentials? What are the essentials? Who gets to define? How do you know what's essential? And again, sometimes they'll come back and say, well, you know, if it has to pertain to justification or salvation, you know, the eternal life, that's essential. And if it's just these little things about, you know, church government or the nature of the sacraments, maybe that's not essential. And that's usually the kind of answer you'll get. Again, I'm going to say, okay, how do you know that's essential? What's the principle you're using to distinguish, well, this pertains to salvation and that doesn't? How do you know that only things pertaining to salvation
right,
are essential?
Right.
And secondly, how do you know these things don't pertain to salvation? Now, commonly in evangelical Protestantism, they'll say we'll agree to disagree on church government and the sacraments. That's where most disagreements in Protestantism happen. They happen over church government and the sacraments. They say we'll disagree about that, but we'll agree on the nature of the Bible and the nature of salvation.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, it might surprise you to know that the original Protestants themselves did not see it that way. They thought that the matter of the sacraments was absolutely essential and that proper knowledge of the sacraments was necessary for salvation. An agreement was necessary for salvation. So John Calvin writes in 1540 and publishes in 1541 a little book called Le Petit Tracté sur la Sainte-Seine, the little treatise on the Lord's Supper, in which he makes explicit the claim. Go look it up on the internet. All right, makes explicit the claim. Protestantism is divided over the nature of the Eucharist, and that this is scandalous and dangerous because proper knowledge of the Eucharist is necessary for salvation, and it's necessary for the Protestant community to come to one mind on this issue. Luther thought that the Swiss, who he called them the sacramentarians, Zwingli, Bullinger, and the like,
uh-huh.
were worse than the papists. That's how he would frame it. He called them false brethren and absolutely rejected them as outside of redemption. Okay. So, I mean, these are some of the things that I would bring up. All right. How do you make these kinds of principled judgments that this or that is necessary for salvation or agreement's not necessary? When Jesus himself tells us it is his desire that we all be one in a visible way, John 17, so the world can know that Christ came forth from the Father. Or St. Paul, who says we have to agree on everything. Or again, in Ephesians chapter 3, when he says that the purpose of the redemption we have in Christ is so that male, female, Jew, Greek, slave, free, all people can be visibly reconciled in the one society of the Catholic Church, Ephesians 3, verse 10.
Very good. Hey, thank you very much for that. And Chris, we hope that's helpful for you. Our phone number here, 1-800-585-9396. This is Call to Communion on EWTN. Have you heard about Amazon Echo or its little brother, Amazon Dot? I will tell you about this from my own personal experience. If you were to walk into our kitchen, right next to the coffee pot, you would see a little Amazon device called the Dot. The bigger version of that is the Echo. It's about 5 inches tall. This one is about the size of a hockey puck. All I have to do is say, Alexa, play EWTN. Boom, it starts playing whatever program is on. What a great way to listen to the Mass in the morning, or Morning Glory, or our program, or Catholic Answers Live. Imagine that in your kitchen. This is a wonderful device, and it's really changing the way people use radio and audio. And I'm very much a fan of this, because I get to hear EWTN right there in my home. No muss, no fuss. It's great. So check out the Amazon Echo today. You can find it all over the place, or the smaller version, the Amazon Dot. They are fantastic. Back to the phones we go at 1-800-585-9396. Here is Mark in Chicago, listening to EWTN Radio on WSFI. Hey there, Mark. What's your question today?
Oh, well, thank you for taking my call, and sure. I really appreciate the show here. And my question, I'm going to try to be brief and articulate it well. And you've answered this question before, but it hasn't been satisfying for my intellect. And okay. So it starts this way.
Okay.
It's around the original fall and Genesis. And so it starts with the God creates the world in 7 days, and after each day he says that this is good. And then at the end of creation, he looks at all creation and says, this is very good. And so this, the reason why I bring this up is because in one call in the past, you made a distinction when the caller asked about the death of Adam and evolution, and you made a distinction that maybe there's a distinction between the physical and the spiritual death, and that it could be referred to as the spiritual death was happening, but then there was possibly the existence of a physical death before the fall. And so that brought up in my mind was, well, if the only instance we have in Scripture when God says something's good is himself, and we look at death as an imperfection, then would that preclude the existence of the physical death before the fall in that case? Because that's the only comparison we have when God says something is good is himself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. So, first of all, it's a dogma of the Catholic faith that Adam and Eve had as a preternatural gift prior to the fall, immortality. Bodily immortality was included as a preternatural gift, along with infused knowledge and integrity, the absence of concupiscence. All of these things were that Adam and Eve enjoyed. They also enjoyed the gift of sanctifying grace, the infusion of God's very own nature and character into their lives so that they were children of God in loving communion with him. And through the fall, not only did they lose sanctifying grace, but they also lost the preternatural gifts. So they lost immortality, bodily immortality, physical immortality. They lost that infused knowledge, and they lost that integrity. So that the wounds of sin, the wounds of original sin in us, mm-hmm. Are ignorance of our true vocation to God and the supernatural life, concupiscence, our intellect, our reason does not control adequately our bodily passions, weakness, we're morally weak, it's difficult to do the good, and then there's one I'm missing. We got ignorance, concupiscence, weakness, malice. That's the other one.
Malice
is the fourth wound of original sin.
All right.
And that is an immoderate love of our own excellence, egotism, essentially. All right.
Okay.
So how does that play in with the question you're raising about whether biological death could have existed prior to the fall? Well, it didn't exist in Adam and Eve. It didn't exist in Adam and Eve. Okay. Now, speculatively, now we're moving outside the realm of Catholic dogma, and we're just moving into how do we reconcile what we know about Adam and Eve with what we can presume on the basis of the biological and anthropological sciences. Do we have to conclude that there was no biological death whatsoever in any species prior to the fall? And I don't think we have to conclude that. And I think that wouldn't make a lot of sense. I mean, if Adam and Eve were eating plants, they were probably digging them up. You know, there's biological death right there.
Sure. Okay. Appreciate that. Thank you so much for your call, Mark. Let's go to Larry in Evergreen, Colorado. This is interesting because we've been talking about Martin Luther today, and Larry has another question about Martin Luther. What is that, Larry?
Well, you know, we've talked about Luther and his interior condition. And so what I was wondering is, you know, how would we plays Satan into to this whole spectrum of what was going on, and you know, because I don't hear, and I know in this world Satan exists, and we fight him every day, especially people who work in ministry. So, and you'll, and if you're a priest, if you're a deacon, you know, they go through terrible trials when it comes to life, and they're, and that's why they do the liturgy of the hours and so on. So I was just wondering, you know, where does that fit in?
Okay, you know, thanks. I appreciate the question a lot. So accusations of being in league with the devil were freely bandied about in the 16th century on both sides of the Protestant-Catholic divide. Luther and the Lutheran and Reformed tradition both freely identified the Pope with the Antichrist, and Catholic polemicists at the time returned the favor and identified Luther with the Antichrist. All right, there was a lot of Antichrist swapping going around in the 16th century, and of course Luther believed himself to be in frequent confrontation with the devil. You often heard, I'm sure, about his famous claim to have thrown an inkwell at the devil in the Wartburg Castle there. Now, to what obviously, the devil was involved in, you can't have the kind of bloodshed and warfare and, you know, brother-on-brother violence that occurred in the 16th and 17th century without the devil being involved. Is it necessary to ascribe the devil immediately to Luther's creative invention of his peculiar doctrines? Well, that's obviously something that's way beyond my purview. And I think historians of dogma, intellectual historians who study Lutheranism, find an awful lot of precedent for Luther's views. Not Luther's system as a whole was unique. I mean, he thought it up out of whole cloth. But there are a lot of elements that help make Luther intelligible, drawn from this and that strand of late medieval Catholic tradition. So my inclination when I'm studying Luther or Calvin or any intellectual question is to try to situate it in its historical context and make sense of it, you know, in the terms that I have. And I think we've made pretty good headway in understanding Luther as a man of his times. You know, but in a general sense, you know, was the devil active and people lopping off each other's heads and, you know, being furiously angry at one another? Of course he is.
Larry, thank you so much for your call. Our phone number, 1-800-585-9396. Julie is checking us out on YouTube right now. Hey, Julie. She says, I heard someone say that Jesus was broken, and through a broken man we gained salvation. So, was Jesus broken?
Well, his bones weren't. Not a bone.
That's true.
Not a bone broken.
Yeah.
Not a bone broken. So, I guess it depends on what you mean by broken. Wounded.
Yeah.
Clearly wounded.
Yeah.
By his stripes were healed. That's what the prophet says.
Okay. Very good. Here's one now from Christine. Thank you for sharing your time with all of us. Could you please share how one finds encouragement and holds on to inner peace while not compromising one's values, beliefs, morals, and convictions in the workplace? I have struggled to maintain long-term employment within the accounting field. From my experience, I have found it quite discouraging as well as paralyzing sometimes to see how the business world can be incredibly cutthroat, impersonal, dehumanizing, manipulative, unapologetic, dishonest, etc. How do I find comfort as I find myself re-entering the workforce more often than I would like? I am educated and baffled that I struggle with this. God bless, Christine.
Thanks, Christine. Appreciate it. First of all, we need to distinguish different kinds of moral cooperation with evil. Right? The Catholic Church acknowledges something called formal cooperation. That's when you intend the evil. So, you know, you work in an accounting firm, and let's say your boss comes in and tells you to falsify some financial documents because we're trying to boost the stock of the client or whatever. And you say, yeah, sure, go and do it. All right? That's formal cooperation with evil. You're intending to be dishonest. Right, that's always wrong. Okay, then there's material cooperation, which is, you know, the boss says we're going to falsify the financial documents, and the secretary walks in and hands him a pencil, and he uses that pencil to write out the false documents. Well, that secretary provided material that was instrumental in doing that evil deed, but clearly did not intend formally to bring about that end. That's material cooperation. And material cooperation can be proximate, can be very immediate. All right, I'm providing you something that makes it, you're absolutely depending on to do your evil deed, and it can be rather remote. You know, so you know, I buy stock in a corporation that you know, that in turn buys a product manufactured by somebody who does business with a third world dictator. You know, you name it. I mean, it's pretty remote cooperation. That's very far removed, and I'm totally not responsible there, right? So a lot of times when we're involved in the workplace, we may find ourselves in some form of material cooperation with evil, all right? And under certain circumstances, that's allowable, all right? And almost impossible to avoid, almost impossible to avoid. You know, my dad, who was an attorney and a corporate attorney and did a lot of transactions, said, David, you know, if I only did business with moral men, I would starve to death. And that's true. You know, you can't avoid being in the world to a certain extent, but you can avoid formal cooperation with evil.
Okay.
Right? Secondly, lay people have a particular vocation, right, that the church calls us to, which is precisely to insert ourselves in these kinds of situations to bear witness and to be a light. And you don't have to explain the entire gospel message every time you open your mouth. But you ought to live the gospel message every time you take a step, all right? Through the charity of our hearts, our fidelity, our honesty, our goodwill, our pursuit of the common good. These are our peculiar vocation, is to make Christ present in the world by our words and by our actions, precisely in these kinds of spheres.
Christine, thank you so much for your note. Can you handle one more question on Luther?
Oh, I'm having fun with
Luther. Okay, right, okay.
So
this is
it.
From John in Vancouver, Washington. He's quoting Will Durant's Story of Civilization, Volume 6. You may be familiar with that. He's talking about a meeting of Luther before the Diet. And Durant quotes Luther as saying, "I do not accept the authority of popes and councils, for they have contradicted each other." Now, Luther did not give examples of contradictions, and Eck did not counter Luther's claim. So, was Luther correct? Are there examples of popes and councils contradicting each other? If so, what are the examples? If not, why wasn't Luther's false statement challenged?
Okay, thanks. So, the Catholic understanding of the authority of popes and councils is nuanced.
Okay.
Is nuanced. And the First Vatican Council, which defined the dogma of papal infallibility, takes that into account and says the Pope is only infallible when he intends, in a formal act, to define a matter of faith or practice as binding on all the Christian faithful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's his most solemn authoritative act. And that is presumed in a lot of papal theology down through 2,000 years into the teaching of Christ himself, who said to St. Peter, "Whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven. What you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. I give to you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. The gates of hell will not prevail against it, and I'll be with you to the end of the age." And the Pope has always been the final court of appeal in the Church, not only on jurisdictional matters, but also on matters of faith and practice. And St. Thomas Aquinas raises... Well, now I'm running out of time, okay? But is it possible to find non-infallible statements, prudential judgments, you know, practical interventions in which you can discern tensions in papal statements or conciliar statements? Of course. And there are a lot of councils that were held or synods that were not ecumenical, that were not infallible. And, of course, Luther is not, he's not acknowledging any of these kinds of distinctions. And his ultimate purpose is not to make fine theological analysis of the papal magisterium. It's really to get to his fundamental dogma about justification. So he's going to throw the entire church out the window if he has to substantiate his theological position.
There it is, John. Thank
you.
And
by the way, Durant's not a good author on the Reformation.
I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah.
John, thank you for your letter. Dr. David Andrews, thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Tom.
See you tomorrow here on this program, Call to Communion on EWTN. I'm Tom Price. Have a great day. God bless.